And welcome back. Conor Doyle here in the seat. I'm delighted to say we have on the phone Sean Sheerwin. Good morning, Sean. How are you?
Good morning, Conor. Very well, thanks.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show, because we tried to get you a couple of weeks ago, but but you were kind of tied up. I'll explain to our listeners. Sean was a huge influence on the amazing events which took place a couple of weeks ago around the Thomas Kent funeral. And, like, Thomas Kent was the only person who was executed outside Dublin in of the 1916 revolution. And Sean, how like, I'm reading some of the stuff here. You were first involved in the Mountjoy 10, the Forgotten 10. Yeah. Isn't that correct?
That's right. That was back in the year 2000 and 2001. And on that occasion, there were 10 families that I was acting as a sort of a liaison person. That is to say, between the families on the one hand and the different departments, prison service and Department of Justice, Department of Taoiseach on the other hand. And so in that sense, having done that then, and it turned out very successfully, I was pretty well determined that we weren't going to forget Thomas Kent.
Yeah, well, this is it, because, like I excuse my ignorance, but, like, he wasn't somebody that I remember from a history in school.
No, and that's understandable, Conor, because sometimes people thought that Thomas Kent was Eamon Cant.
Oh, right, okay.
Because Eamon Cant, obviously, is in the English vernacular, is Eamon Kent.
Right.
But in fact, a different person entirely. Now, he was one of the leaders in the Dublin area. Thomas Kent and indeed his brothers and others, they would have been involved with famous people like Terence McSweeney and Curtin and those in Cork. Now, remember, in 1916, it wasn't a very public announced affair for the volunteers to take the offensive against the British occupation in Dublin or throughout the country. It was done by way of secrecy, and they would have always held an Easter time manoeuvre, that is to say, just a manoeuvre of volunteers. The volunteers, as listeners will probably know, is the forerunner of the Irish Army, the official Irish Army, the Defence Forces.
Yeah.
And the issue then was that they were in response, they were established in response to the Ulster Volunteers, because the Ulster Volunteers didn't want any truck with United Ireland at the time and Home Rule and of all of that history. So they established the Ulster Volunteers, and they were plied with arms and all types of weaponry from the UK. So what was the Irish going to do? So they established the Irish Volunteers. Now, in Cork and down in the south, the branches of the Irish Volunteers were established and throughout the country, and they held manoeuvres probably every weekend. And on this particular occasion, as you might remember, Owen McNeill decided that because the weaponry didn't come in the odd from Germany that Roger Casement was bringing from Germany, but because they didn't arrive successfully in Ireland, the rising of 1916 was cancelled. Now, of course, they didn't have mobile phones.
No, they didn't have social media.
That's right.
Yeah, so, you couldn't Twitter everybody.
They put actually a notification in the Sunday Independent. Can you just imagine?
And the
notification was manoeuvres, the Irish Volunteers manoeuvres are cancelled forthwith, and for obviously volunteers to take heed of that. Now, that was on Sunday, Easter Sunday. Now, what happened then was the section of the volunteers that would be regarded as hardliners, the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, they decided that come what was to happen, they were going to rise on Easter Monday. And so Easter Monday then became the starting day of the Easter Rising. And, of course, pretty soon, within 4 or 5 days of the start, it was competed with by the British, and reinforcements came from the UK, and of course the rising in the military sense ceased with the surrender, because Patrick Pearse and others didn't want to bring innocent people into difficulties. Some had died, some had had become injured, etc., and they were innocent. So, but Thomas Kent, you see, and his brothers and others down in Cork, they were waiting. They understood the thing had been the rising had been cancelled, but they didn't know how it was going to follow through. And they decided that they wouldn't, for safety's sake, for their own personal safety, they decided not to live at home, not to sleep in their houses, because they feared that there would be reprisals as a result of the rising in Dublin, and that they would be captured, and they didn't certainly want that to happen. So they slept away in safe areas, and then probably came back to do their farming and other work during the daytime. Unfortunately, Thomas Kent and his brothers came back on the night before the 2nd of May, and slept in their own home. And the house was surrounded by the RIC, that's the Royal Irish Conservatory. And at daybreak, they were called upon to surrender. Now, they had three or four weapons in the house and a small amount of ammunition. So when the RIC said, look, we're going to have to deal with this, you're going to have to surrender, you're going to have to come out and give up your arms and surrender to us. And they refused, and they had remembered and recalled, apparently, Owen McNeill's order before the rising ever took place in Dublin, that if people in the volunteers were contacted in that fashion by the RIC, that they weren't to surrender, and they weren't to do what the British now, or at least what the Irish RIC, that's the Irish Constabulary, when they asked them to surrender, they didn't. So a gunfight arose, and the when the weapons were used, when the ammunition was used up, they hadn't anything else but to surrender. And so they came from upstairs, they came down, they presented themselves to the RIC, that had been reinforced at that stage by the local British Army post in Fermoy. And Richard, actually, who was a well-known athlete of the territory around, he decided to bolt for freedom, and he jumped over one of the fences surrounding the house, and he ran across a field. Unfortunately, he was shot at, and he was injured badly, and he died a couple of days later from those wounds.
Right.
Others then were captured and brought to Fermoy Barracks, and that included their mother, because their mother was an 82, 83-year-old person at the time, and she, as much as she could, she kept the few weapons that were available to them loaded and handed over to the boys of the family. Now we have to kind of remember that Thomas Kent was 52 years of age.
All right, so he wasn't a young fellow. Well,
he was young, but he wasn't as young as a lot of other people in the volunteers and indeed those in Dublin. Like, most of them were in their 20s and early 30s, but this fellow was very active for a number of years in land action. You know, the activity where Irish people needed land.
Yeah, the Land League and all that kind of stuff.
The Land League. And so they were very active in that. And Thomas Kent was active when the GAA was formed, and he was active in the Irish organisation, the Irish-speaking organisations. In fact, he was even active when the total abstinence, you know, the pioneer.
Yes, the pioneers, yeah.
Began. Now, I don't want to sound trivial about it, but he was determined that alcohol wasn't going to play a part in his activities as a volunteer. And in fact, he's reputed to have the only unit of the volunteers totally without taking drink.
Right, okay.
And one of the things he did when he was finally ready for his execution, he handed over his pioneer pin, said to the priest in the prison, bring this back to the priest in Castle Lyons and tell him that it was untarnished. That was his phrase.
That was his gush. Used.
Which was another way of saying I didn't drink, because he was offered a drink just before he was executed, and he refused that.
And then,
that's the reason. It's the reason, yeah, why you wouldn't, and your listeners wouldn't readily recall what happened outside of Dublin, because you see the 14 leaders that were captured, and as they were leaders, they were brought to court-martial, and then they were given sentences, some to be deported and some to be executed. And as you know, in Arbor Hill, that's now a location directly behind Collins Barracks, which is the museum there along by the...
Yes, around on the quays, yeah.
Yeah, and Arbor Hill was that particular location where the men of 1916 are buried. That was part of the prison walled-in exercise yard. And any time that I was organising, because for the last number of years I've been organising as a sort of chief marshal an annual event there, we asked that children of our membership would take an Easter lily. Now, these would be fresh Easter lilies that we'd get in the Dublin market. In some cases, the Easter lily standing would be nearly taller than some of the children.
Right, right.
In it.
Yeah.
So we had a nice little ceremony. But in this case, and for the time I started, we included 16 lilies, because the 14 are those that are buried in Arbor Hill. But the other two we were remembering as Roger Casement, because he was executed in England.
In England, yeah.
And then Thomas Kent was executed in Cork. So that gives the full list of 16, that were executed.
And tell me, like, he was buried in the grounds of Cork Prison, isn't that correct? And
yeah.
You know, this is where, you know, the mystery of the whole thing, and the fact that you know, people were told that, unfortunately, his grave had been lost and that somebody had built over it. And,
well, we couldn't, Connor, we tried. When I say we now, when we got the archaeologists involved and the prison services in full cooperation, I have to, of course, acknowledge that the Irish prison services, they wanted very much to find the grave. There was a plaque on the prison wall inside, which was where all of the commemorations over the years, over the 99 years, where that took place. And it was not necessarily believed that that was where the grave was.
Right,
it was
okay.
Surround, in the way that you would see a surround, you know, a curbing surround,
yes,
in front,
yeah,
of that. Now, it was a symbolic, everyone thought it was the symbolic location of where Thomas Kent was buried. But there was rumour on top of rumour, because the prison, it was a detention centre as distinct from a full civilian prison during the British time, and it continued as a detention centre when the Irish volunteers took over for a few years. And then it was only, I think, in the 1950s, that it became a fully fledged Irish prison. And lots of buildings had to be built on very scarce ground, and there was, as I say, rumours given to us, or statements, frankly, believing that it was totally true. Oh, you won't find Thomas Kent's grave. Sure, Thomas Kent's grave has been built over, and you might end up having to dig up buildings as well. So, to tell you the God's honest truth, Connor, I was so determined that even if that was to happen, we would dig up buildings, because there was a new prison in full construction when we began a year ago there. That's now, we began in earnest a year ago. Prior to that, we would have had meetings and discussions and planning for it, But the new prison is practically fully built now, which is right beside the old prison. And the Department of Prisons, that's the Irish Prison Services, they said to us, look, why don't you wait until the new prison is completed? And then when we mothball the old prison, you can do the business of finding Thomas Kent,
yeah.
To your heart's desire. I mean, it wasn't a throwaway remark. Like, it was helping us to realise that we would have no restrictions going into a prison that's a fully fledged prison with all its security and all its procedures.
Yeah.
The problem about that, Connor, was that I felt that if we waited until the new prison was fully handed over and the old prison closed, it would be not just next year, it would be probably the year later.
Yes, yeah.
And therefore, it was, to me, it was a disgrace that here is a man who did what he did in times that are far, far different to what they are today, and who was executed in 1916, and now it was 99 years later,
yeah,
and he still was within prison walls.
Yes.
And if we were to wait for a year or two more,
yeah,
well, we'd only be just adding, in our own time, we'd be adding fault on top of fault. So we decided to work away, and we brought in, at least the archaeologists brought in, geophysical equipment. Now, that geophysical equipment, Connor, is where you have machinery, electronic machinery, that would pass over the ground area and would send off signals that would penetrate the ground underneath. Now, when that signal returned to the equipment, the geophysical equipment, it would have a certain reading.
Now, right,
when,
okay,
when the experts then examined that reading, here's what they found, that all the way across the terrain in front of that wall, which includes the plaque and the grave area, there was no equipment, no return to anywhere else along that wall except where the grave is.
Right, so the grave was actually on the right spot then.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. We knew then that there was no... They referred to it as a cutting, a sort of if there was a geophysical signature,
right,
consistent with a grave, which meant that the ground was cut.
Right. Okay. So somebody had hewn out a piece of ground.
Exactly. Now, if that was what the information came back with, we knew that there was a grave, and that's exactly what happened. The problem is, we didn't know was any human remains likely to be found, and if human remains were found, we didn't know in advance whether they were the human remains of Thomas Kent. Because we learned from the authorities and from anecdotal information that several people were killed, executed, or died in the prison area, and it could have been any one of them.
Right, it could have been, right. But then you did the DNA testing.
So we did. So then what happened then was, having gotten the start approved by the prison authorities, we got the license from Cork County Council or Cork City Council, and then we started the excavation. Now, the excavation meant that we took up the surround, and underneath that surround was another surround, another curbing. And would you believe, underneath the second curbing, there was a third curbing. Now, that brought us down from present-day level to 1916 level.
Right, okay.
So having done that, we found that there was a big slab of concrete where it was marked across, obviously done at the time when concrete was wet.
Yeah.
And so we broke up that concrete slab, and then we had a mixture of soil and mud rock and shale. And the ground was very, very bad and not easy for anybody to dig a grave, irrespective of who it was for. But in fact, when the archaeologists got working then, in June, they found that that very, very close to the surface.
Right.
That's the surface of 1916 surface, was the remains. And so he was actually buried in no deeper than about 18 inches.
Gosh, and yet it survived, which his body survived, which is absolutely incredible over 100, nearly 100 years.
Yeah, not only that, Conor, people said, as you probably know, he was buried in quicklime, covered in quicklime.
Yeah.
The same as 1916 were buried in quicklime.
Right.
And in fact, let me say that the bone structure of the skeletal remains of Thomas Kent, and indeed I understand also in the 1916, because there was some adjustment made to where the 1916 leaders were laid, and the new monument, when I say the new monument that was built in 1966, that's the 50th anniversary. And if anybody goes to Arbor Hill, which I would recommend,
yes, it's a,
people
yeah,
to do that,
yeah.
You know, they will be able to see this new monument. Well, now, that's where the 1916 men are buried. But there was no damage done to the bone structure of the skeletal. Yeah.
Yeah, like it's a fantastic story. And fair play to you for continuing with it, because, you know, like, it's terrible for, as I said, somebody like, I'm 50 something, and, yeah, and I didn't know about this man, and I would have gone through the 1916 50th
ceremonies,
you know,
next year, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and all that, yeah, kind of the 50th, you know, anniversary. And it wasn't somebody that was ever on my radar or history or whatever, which is shocking, you know.
Yeah.
But I have to say, fair play to you. And can I just ask you, is there anybody else out there that, you know, is, what's your next project that you're going to, being serious, like, is there other forgotten heroes, or, you know, kind of revolutionaries, as they're now called, still haven't received a proper burial?
Well, it's not now that I have the ambition to continue.
A grave
robber.
No, but it's not, Sean. Like, in fairness,
I know exactly, and I know the seriousness of your of your question. And one of the things that I felt very privileged is that I knew the system. I knew the steps that had to be taken, because I had done it
previously
with the authority of Bertie Ahern at the time, because he was the Taoiseach at the time, and he asked me, once I got... there was a little problem back in the year 2000. I hope I'm not taking up too much of your time. But
we've a few more minutes. You're going grand,
well,
John. Don't worry.
One of the families in the
original Forgotten Ten.
Yeah, they felt very concerned, because their relative, Patrick Moran, he was one of six people executed in Mountjoy in the hangman's house. In Mountjoy on the same morning, 2 at 6 o'clock, 2 at 7, and 2 at 8. And they genuinely believed that all six were buried in the one grave.
Right, okay.
Now, they felt, out of sheer respect for the remains of all of those six people, that to try and separate the remains of the six people, to have them reburied,
would be difficult.
Was a disgrace, or was not certainly what they would like.
Yeah, now, and that's fair enough.
And what happened then was, I got from the National Graves Association, which is a non-political voluntary body that looks after graves all over Ireland. It's a wonderful body, and they don't get any states. They don't actually want state. I often wanted them to try and take some contribution from the state, but they said no. We're going to keep completely clear of state's support. So they get voluntary support. But anyway, they gave me a map, which was sketched out by the British military back in 1916 in the Dublin area.
Right.
And this map said, in a handwritten, or, you know, in a typed note, but signed by the two officers, one to the other, he said, please make sure that you file this in safety, because it may be needed sometime in the future. Now, how prophetic
is that?
In 1916. So the officer
obviously knew.
And he knew that someday regulations might change, because they normally don't allow families to get their hands on the remains after a political sort of execution
like that
was. But in fact, that map showed that there were 10 graves, each one marked out for
each of
the 10 people.
Right.
So we went back to the family of Patrick Moran. I got the civil servant who was handling it. He went back, visited Krosna in Roscommon and met with May Moran, who he explained the full extent and the full importance of this particular map. And she was delighted because she had learned through her relations that some who had now died in the meantime, that this is what was believed at the time to have happened. So because of that, we had a map showing exactly their location. So that meant that the excavation and the exhumation in Mountjoy was made an awful lot easier. Now, we didn't have such a map in Cork. There was no sketch, there was no information. And so we had to take a chance, and the chance turned out to be correct. And we had, interestingly enough, the Garda Technical Bureau, in conjunction with UCD Forensic Department, they have just now this year, last year, they have put together an expert team, which means that any such examination of a DNA nature, no matter how technically difficult it is, it can be now done in Ireland and not have to be sent abroad to England or elsewhere for testing purposes and for identification. So that was a great,
fantastic. Well, Sean, unfortunately, we have to call a day to this, but we will definitely have you on again. But can I just say, I don't know if I'm allowed to say congratulations on this. You know, I suppose, you know,
when you do, Conor, you have, through me, you have to congratulate, and I will certainly do it, because we're bringing all of the key people that were involved. We're going to bring them to a visit to Leinster House.
Later this month, certainly,
and I'll be able to tell them what you said, because the thanks to me is really a thanks to the team of people that
who completed this.
Exactly.
Well, Sean, thank you very much indeed, and thanks for coming on. That was a great chat, and we'll definitely have you on again, and I'm sure I'll talk to you again. Thanks a lot, Sean. Cheers.
Most welcome.
Thank you very much.